the 2006 International AIDS Conference, Time to Deliver, brought to you by KaiserNetwork.org.
Good morning, everyone. I'm Craig McClure, the Executive Director of the International AIDS Society, and welcome to the rapporteur session for the 16th International AIDS Conference. Since the first conference in 1985, it has evolved from a small scientific meeting to become the largest, most inclusive, and diverse platform for global advocacy, sharing of data, and lessons learned and partnership building to end the devastation due to HIV and AIDS. Throughout this week, the original quilt designed by HIV-positive Canadian artist Joe Average for the 11th International AIDS Conference in 1996, held in Vancouver, the last time the meeting was in North America, has been displayed to my left. It serves to remind us of the enormous change that has occurred in our collective response to AIDS since the advent of antiretroviral therapy announced at that meeting, and of the ongoing relevance of its theme, One World, One Hope. 10 years later, with dramatically increased resources, commitments, and knowledge, it is time to deliver. In 1998, the community program was formalized, recognizing that the engagement of people living with HIV and AIDS and the communities most at risk of HIV infection, including gay men and men who have sex with men, injecting drug users, sex workers, migrant populations, women and girls generally, and other groups, could no longer be sidelined at the conference or in the response. In 2004, in Bangkok, the conference added the Leadership Program, as well as the Global Village. The Leadership Program noted the critical importance of leadership across all sectors to respond effectively to the epidemic. Also in that year, the Youth Program was formalized, highlighting the role of young people today and tomorrow in shaping the AIDS response. Since 2004, the International AIDS Society has embarked itself on a process of change. A consultative living process called Future Directions was initiated to review the vision and the goals of the conference and shift it from being simply a five-day event to part of an ongoing process of scientific inquiry, education, information sharing, advocacy, and accountability for our collective action in the fight against AIDS. Working with our co-organizers, the Global Network of People Living with HIV, the International Community of Women Living with HIV and AIDS, the International Council of AIDS Service Organizations, UNAIDS, the local host and Canadian AIDS Society, along with the hundreds of dedicated individuals working on the planning committees, the conference director Mats Anlund, program manager Emily Blitz, and local host director and program activity, local host director Daryl Perry, and program activities manager Nikki Stein, we have begun to implement many of the recommendations coming out of Future Directions. We have a long way to go. But I think that this conference has increased the dialogue, the participation of diverse stakeholders, and begun to address issues of accountability in the response. The program this week has reflected the critical elements of science, the community response, mobilizing and building leadership across all sectors, and links to the social drivers of the epidemic, and the positioning of the conference in the field of AIDS and the field of AIDS as a movement for social change. A new feature of the program has been the key challenges. Five key challenges in the response to AIDS have been followed through this week. These are accelerating research to end the epidemic, expanding and sustaining human resources to scale up prevention and treatment, intensifying involvement of affected individuals and communities, and building new leadership to advance the response. Over the past 5 days, under the coordination of Chris Collins, 63 experts have volunteered their time and energy to follow the entire program and pull together rapporteur summaries of over 4,000 abstracts, including oral and poster sessions, 64 non-abstract-driven sessions, 100 skills-building sessions, 140 satellite meetings, 4 plenary sessions, 40 global village sessions, youth sessions, as well as affiliated events and other program activities, such as the cultural program and the outreach program. This has been no easy feat. Today, the lead rapporteurs for each of the 5 scientific tracks, the community program, the leadership program, and youth program, along with one lead rapporteur summarizing the 5 key challenges, will report back on the synthesis of their coverage of the program. Following the conference, for the first time, we will be producing a policy report that incorporates the rapporteur summaries and analyzes the discussions that have taken place this week and the directions that these discussions have pointed us in to strengthen the response. In addition, a comprehensive evaluation of the conference that has included interviews and surveys throughout this week will be followed up immediately after the conference with an online survey to all delegates who have attended. Before we begin, some basic information about how this morning will go. The rapporteur session will run until 11 a.m., which will be followed by a short 15-minute break to allow the technicians to set up for the closing session. I'd ask you to either remain in the room, or if you need to, go to the bathroom, come back, but don't go too far away, because at 11:15, we'll be starting sharp with a performance by Yvonne Chaka Chaka of South Africa. And then heading straight into the closing session at 11:30, which will feature Stephen Lewis as the keynote speaker. And now I would like to introduce our first lead rapporteur for Track A, Pathogenesis and Biology of HIV, Dr. Rafiq Sekely from Canada.
Thank you, Craig. And first of all, I really would like to thank the organizers and my colleague and friend Mark Weinberg to have provided me with this opportunity, which looked initially like a poison gift, but at the end was really a very good learning experience. I also would like to thank all the attendees, the delegates, the presenters for a great meeting, which has been very challenging, extremely energizing, and motivating to help us continue to work together. And finally, I'd like to apologize for those of you who are going to see a lot of Track A jargon slides, but I think it's important to give credit to presenters for the work they've done. I have had the blessing and the opportunity to work with a very good group of rapporteurs, a very committed, talented, and especially present team. I can't say I was very present at this meeting. I was all over the place, but especially people like Nicole Bernard, Alain Corpin, Michel Tremblay, Rupert Cole, Keith Hawk are really the one who did the job, and I'm the one who's here today to present to you what they have done. So my presentation will be divided into 3 major areas. The first one is a concurrent theme, which really is, a major area of investigation around the role of immune activation in HIV disease progression and susceptibility to infection. This is really an area that was highlighted by Françoise Barré-Sinoussier in her plenary session, how the immune system reacts to HIV and whether sometimes the way that the immune system reacts and in an overdrive situation really is something that is driving the progression of HIV infection. And there are several strategies, in fact, that the virus or the milieu has led to this aberrant or immune response that is really driving the infection. The first one was highlighted by Mayer et al. That showed, in fact, that HIV has regions that stimulate the innate immune system through TLR7 and 8 receptors and can lead to chronic immune activation. So within the viral genome, there are sequences that are inducing aberrant immune activation, and this immune activation is really what is driving sometimes the evolution of HIV infection. And in this work, in fact, what we show is that when we put together T lymphocytes with several sequences derived from the HIV genome, RNA sequences, we can see, in fact, that they induce the activation of a molecule called CD69, which is an activation marker of T cells, and you can see that very clearly in this quadrant. Another strategy, in fact, that the virus or the immune system has counteracted in order to be able to neutralize infection is something that we have seen in people who are exposed and not infected, and this is the work of Blake Ball, who has shown, in fact, that in women who are exposed and uninfected, they show greater sensitivity to TLR stimulation by producing more immunosuppressive IL-10 rather than immunostimulatory interferon gamma cytokines. And this is shown on the next slide, where, in fact, if you look at women who are exposed and infected, they produce a lot of IL-10 and little gamma interferon as compared to the individuals who are chronically infected. More evidence for the role of systems that downregulate the immune response and in controlling HIV infection is provided by animal models where African guinea monkeys who have non-pathogenic HIV infection have higher amount of regular T cells, and regular T cells is a subset of cells that you've learned, I mean, to work with over the past 5 years, and these cells are cells that keep the system in check and provide and prevent hyperimmune activation. And it's clear that, again, through the work of Barachek, that in African green monkeys, there is much higher prevalence of cells that express FOXP3, which is a marker of those T regulatory T cells in their mucosal tissue, and that is a mechanism by which, again, the immune system is kept in check, and whereby we prevent hyperimmune activation. And finally, in this portion of the work, I mean, the role of inflammatory cytokines was highlighted by Dr. François Barré-Simici, who again showed that in African guinea monkeys versus rhesus monkeys, African guinea monkeys who are able to who are infected but keep the do not develop disease, while rhesus macaques who develop disease, there are very strong difference in the pattern of cytokines they produce. With resistant macaques expressing TGF-beta, FOXP3, IL-10, interferon alpha, SMAD4, all molecules which are anti-inflammatory, or cells which are anti-inflammatory, while people who develop HIV produce a generalized T-cell activation, and that leads, I mean, to progression of the HIV infection. So this, I think, and Dr. François Barré-Simici highlighted this, has, I think, some very important implication in terms of eventual vaccine development or strategies to neutralize HIV infection. And I think one thing that she has postulated is the fact that a vaccine candidate has both to target the infection and also the very early pathogenic signals, so molecules that can be used to neutralize the immune activation that we see in infected individuals, and also other strategies including gene silencing, again, I mean, to neutralize molecules that drive HIV infection. So the second topic which I would like to discuss with you a little bit is a theme which is very dear to me, which is the development of HIV vaccines, which we know is going to be the ultimate strategy in trying to prevent the progression of the epidemic. And one of the major problems that we face in human in generating good vaccines, especially which are rationally based vaccines, is the development of good adjuvants. And in the session on preclinical vaccine development, there were several presentations about development of novel adjuvants that can trigger efficient immune responses. One of them, in fact, dealt with the use of molecules which are inherent to the immune system, and and can drive a strong, efficient, effective T-cell which can kill their target cells. And among these molecules is a molecule called 4-1BB ligand, which when you introduce this into a vaccine, you induce much higher levels of cytokine production, much higher levels of interferon production, much higher levels of proliferation, and much higher level of killer T-cells. So that's clearly something that we need to put eventually into a vaccine or to consider molecules that are analogous to this one. Another one which also was highlighted during the session is a molecule called CD40 ligand, which when you incorporate this into a viral vector, that molecule also is capable of highlighting or inducing much more efficient immune responses. On the other end, and as I said in the beginning, I mean, we need molecules that can stop HIV replication. And again, during the session, the group of Dr. Fakhruddin showed that interleukin-27 is a molecule which is triggered by HPV VLPs, and this molecule, in fact, which is produced by monocytes, can very efficiently inhibit viral replication in CD4 cells and in monocytes. So these molecules, in fact, constitute several elements that you can use in order to build a better vaccine. Also, I think what's very important, and people are still continuing to work on this, is the development of vectors or delivery systems that can induce potent immune activation. And one of the groups at this workshop symposium showed, in fact, that a chimeric virus containing the fibers of adeno-75 is very extremely efficient in infecting dendritic cells, dendritic cells being the most potent cells in triggering immune responses. And this has a very clear effect on the efficacy of vaccine, because they showed that when you use this vaccine to immunize macaques, now you're able, I mean, to in a therapeutic vaccine context, you're able now to completely eliminate viral load from infected macaques, while other strategies like DNA or other vectors are not able at all to contain viral replication after stopping treatment. So strategies like these chimeric viruses, in addition to the adjuvants that I discussed briefly before, are strategies that we need to pursue to continue our efforts in building. Coming back, I mean, to the issue of hyperimmune activation, and I think, I mean, that also deals with building, I think, more efficient vaccine. We need not only to target HIV, but we also need to target other pathogens which are present in the milieu and which can drive HIV replication. One of them is HSV2, and from the work of Robert Cole's group, we can see, in fact, that so mathematical modeling and some of their data that 50% of new HIV cases can be directly attributed to HSV2. And how does HSV2 in fact does this? Is by inducing a milieu, in fact, where HIV can replicate much more efficiently. And again, it deals with the presence of highly activated T cells. Again, in HSV infected individuals, you can see that you have a lot of CD4 cells that express the activation marker CD69, and also a lot of cells that express CD69. That provides, I mean, a milieu for the virus to replicate. So if you're able to get rid of HSV2, that also will help, I think, create a more efficient environment for vaccines to be more efficacious. And I mean, the model that Cole and his colleagues have developed, in fact, is a model where HSV2 infection increases DC sign, which is a receptor for HIV, on immature T cells, increases CCR5, which is a core receptor for HIV on CD4 T cells. That favors HIV infection. You get now to HSV2 reactivation setting, and again, you continue the cycle. So if you were able to break this cycle, that's going to provide, I think, a better environment to have good vaccines. And of course, if you don't break that cycle, I think vaccines will have a lot of problems in being efficient. Again, in the area of vaccine, I think one area that we have been working a lot into is trying to identify correlates of protection. And again, I mean, the group of Pavlakis and Felber published, I mean, together with Dr. Ledvin and Nebel a few weeks ago in Science, evidence that central memory cells are clearly associated with protection which is induced by vaccination. So I think we have for vaccine development, we have I think with some very good targets, some potentially very promising adjuvants, and for the first time we have some correlates of protection that we can work on and that we can mimic and use to benchmark vaccines. And finally, in the last few minutes, I will, 3 minutes I have, I'll talk about some viral determinants which also are inducing viral replication and disease progression. And I think the area of fitness was very much highlighted during this meeting. It's clear that as the disease progresses, the fitness of the virus is increased. And in fact, there are several reasons why the fitness of the virus is increasing. One of them is the removal of sequences which are being recognized by CTLs. But also, it's clearly evidence. There's clear evidence that CTL escape mutation in GAG epitopes can reduce the fitness, but they appear only very late in infection. And this is very different than escape mutations in the envelope, which emerge early but without a significant loss of fitness. So again, I mean, that's, I think, very, very interesting. The other area which I think is very relevant, not only to basic science but also to treatment, is the fact, I mean, that the group of Weiser in Switzerland, using the Swiss cohort, showed in fact that individuals who at baseline have a lot of X4 viruses are individuals who are going to progress much faster and in which therapy is going to be much less efficient. There's other topics like VPR-induced epitopes of T cells and neurons, HIV-induced changes in host gene expression, but I think among the most exciting mechanisms that the virus now is using in order to decoy and to prevent the innate immune response is now that HIV has used a viral decoy RNA to suppress a very novel mechanism that the immune system was using, which is the RNAi defense, which is a mechanism that prevents HIV replication. But again, I mean, the virus has exploited this system and using a viral decoy in order to suppress the cell's RNAi defense. And again, HIV is not only acting on cells that recognize specifically HIV, but it's also altering all the bystander cells. So it's creating a very different environment in the system. And this is shown by the work of Michel Tremblay, Michel Imbeau and his colleagues, where if you take cells, you infect the primary T cells, you infect them, and you look at number of cells which are being infected, they're less than 1%. But if you look at the pattern of gene expression in the whole system, you can see, in fact, that the whole system is being altered in expression. So my final slide is again, I really would like to thank you. This was a really great meeting, and I hope we can keep on working together and have a very successful next meeting. Thank you.
Thank you. I'd like to introduce now James McIntyre from South Africa, the lead rapporteur for Track B, Clinical Research, Treatment and Care.
Thank you very much, Craig, and thank you to the organizers for this opportunity. I too had a great team. They were extraordinarily knowledgeable and talented, and as you can see here, very attractive. And our choice of the highlights from this very, very busy track may not be the same as yours. But I'm going to try to bring you some of what we thought were the key messages. It's been 10 years since we came to Canada for the Vancouver conference that changed the treatment perspective. And in the first years of that decade, we came here to hear how the rich people lived and the poor people died. In Toronto, I think we've seen that that does not need to be the case. The data show that treatment success is blind to race and continent. But we also saw that treatment reaches too many too late, and that low CD4 counts predict mortality. As Kevin de Kock said, treatment delayed is treatment denied. But there's good data in this clinical track that confirms a good response to ART in adults and in children. There's some early data to suggest that nutritional supplements may augment, not replace, but may augment ART outcomes. But more work is needed to really see how to use these. We've heard the numbers in the plenary sessions, 1.65 million people receiving ART worldwide, representing in Africa a tenfold increase in Africans on treatment since December 2003, but a remaining 70% unmet need for ART. We've heard from several speakers and we've seen the evidence that where treatment is freely provided, outcomes are better. The problem remains, as Julia Montana put it, that 90% of the drugs are in the north and 90% of the people who need them are in the south. But we're making some progress, and this slide from Peter Piot's presentation graphically shows that. And there are some outstanding examples of clinical success in rollout programs at country level, across countries, and in health districts. Here's the Elizabeth Glaser Pediatric AIDS Foundation's Project Heart. And it shows you how they've initiated care and ARV treatment for over 68,000 people in 28 months at 95 sites in four African countries. And here is the Lusaka project. 20,000 adults and approaching 2,000 children started on heart in just over 2 years. And as Kevin showed us, the good news is that women are accessing treatment in these projects. In most African programs, women represent around 60% of those on treatment, close to or exceeding their proportion of those in need. But I think that we mustn't forget that other things happen. There's a very trendy economic theory at the moment about the long tail that says that for every market leader, for every iPod that's sold, there are many smaller manufacturers, smaller niche markets that, in fact, added up, total the success of those huge successes, those huge product successes. And I think that's true of ART programs. For these incredible, huge, high-impact programs that I've shown you, there are many thousands of others, the ones that you run, that are reaching hundreds of thousands, millions now, of people with ART. And they're doing it successfully, and they're doing it with good clinical outcome at a community level. It doesn't seem that long since some lead donors were telling us that non-watch-owning Africans couldn't take ART. But the Afro-pessimists have been shown wrong at this meeting. And a meta-analysis presented by Edward Mills of 27 studies in sub-Saharan African countries and 31 North American studies showed that adherence was better. 77% of those in Africa achieving adequate adherence compared to 55% in North America. It's really important that we don't use concern about adherence as a reason to slow down rollout. But it's equally important that we do everything we can to make sure this is sustained. And some data from Senegal and elsewhere pointed the way. Disclosure, the use of treatment buddies, and community involvement are powerful tools in ensuring individuals adhere to treatment. Making that treatment easier is another approach. Julio showed this slide in his plenary talk on one of the ways that we might do this. Reducing the number of pills, reducing the number of doses. And the availability of more potent, better tolerated drugs may mean that simplification of treatment is, as Sharon Walmsley put it, an idea whose time has come. Across the country in Vancouver, we learned that three drugs were essential to control HIV. In Toronto, we're learning that there may be promising control results with just one in some people. And in the late-breaking marathon session yesterday, three independent studies presented that and came to the same conclusions, that for the majority of patients who have not failed a protease inhibitor-containing regimen, including naive patients, Kaletra monotherapy may be an effective, virologically suppressive, and well-tolerated regimen. However, there was caution, and these slides from Cameron's presentation show that compared to the protocol-defined control arms in those studies that contained two NRTIs in combination with Kaletra or efavirenz, greater proportions of patients were detected in the monotherapy arm with low-level viremia, between 50 and 500 copies. And the presenters agreed that the data do not yet support the regular use of Kaletra monotherapy in clinical practice, but that it will be important to identify further how to predict which patient population may benefit from this promising new strategy. There's always a need to look for new and better drugs for HIV treatment. Integrase is one of the three enzymes that HIV needs to replicate in the body, and integrase inhibitors would therefore stop HIV from inserting its genes into uninfected DNA.
The other two enzymes needed for viral replication, the reverse transcriptase and protease, are the targets of the drugs that we already use. The data presented on MK0518 by Marty Markowitz yesterday suggests that integrase inhibitors may be the most promising new class of drugs that we currently have under development. In treatment-naive patients, using four different dose levels and looking at results at 24 weeks, they showed that this drug had a potent antiretroviral activity, that 85 to 95% achieved viral loads less than 50 copies per mil, that they achieved viral suppression faster than with efavirenz, and that the drug was relatively well tolerated. Most of that viral load reduction took place in the first 4 to 8 weeks of taking the drug, and this happened faster than the efavirenz arm shown in white on this slide. And certainly this is looking like a very potent and well-tolerated drug, although we recognize there are several years of testing still to go before it can reach the markets. Let me change track a little. The challenge of bringing together TB and HIV services was an important topic at this conference and at a WHO meeting that preceded it. We've seen that TB is a leading cause of death in Africa and in some settings the leading cause of death among people with HIV. We've seen data here that providing heart may reduce that risk, but even on heart, TB is more common in people living with HIV. Several studies from Uganda and South Africa showed an initial increase in TB incidence in the first 3 to 6 months after starting heart, but that this declined after that time. INH prophylaxis given with heart may be a way to reduce this, and this was suggested in a study from Brazil. And the development of better testing technologies was emphasized as a need. TB is now an ancient and curable disease, so why is it so crucial to act now? A late breaker presentation presented yesterday by Neil Gandhi from Tugela Ferry in South Africa provided sobering analysis on XDR, extensively drug-resistant TB, which is resistant to all first and second line agents. These researchers screened 1,539 patients, 10% of whom, 10%, were resistant to all first and second line drugs, and all of these were HIV infected. Even worse, 98% of them died, and nearly three quarters of these deaths occurred within 30 days of the sputum specimen. Drug-resistant TB and HIV co-infection are challenges that go with us as we leave this conference and require much more research and much more commitment and much more funding. But it's not only about TB. Hepatitis C is another major co-infection occurring with HIV around the world where intravenous drug use is driving the epidemic, especially in the former Soviet republics and in other parts of Europe. The red areas on this slide show where IDU make up more than 80% of AIDS cases. But we also heard that HIV-HCV infection may be important outside of those regions. And this was highlighted in a study from Zanzibar looking at substance users in which 30% were IDU, and of these, 13% were HIV positive and 15% HCV positive, compared to the background of less than 1% for both infections. We know that HIV and HCV co-infection leads to more rapid liver disease than HCV alone. But there were some reassuring data from the Asia-Pacific TAHOD cohort presented by Yiming Chen that showed that co-infection with either HBV or HCV, hepatitis B or C, did not impact on the immunologic response, virologic response, or survival following the initiation of ARV therapy. Alicia Keys entertained you at the opening, but she and her group at Keep a Child Alive are very serious about this. We need to find ways to use antiretroviral formulations for children to develop them and to get them out, and we need to get children on the global treatment agenda. UNICEF estimates that 600,000 children urgently require care. But treating a child, we realize, also means treating that child's mother and family in order to keep a child alive. But we've heard this week the accumulating data from MSF and from others that show that children benefit from ART with low rates of treatment failure and with few toxicities. The barriers to getting more children on treatment include the formulations, but they also include access to early diagnosis and they include the need to treat the healthcare providers to give ARVs to children. They're scared of giving drugs to children. We don't have enough information. And because most of these children don't live in North America, the experience base and the resources to treat others are not yet there. As this slide from Dr. Botanica's presentation shows, ART really does work. But children do not need to be infected. But research on the prevention of mother-to-child transmission was conspicuous by its absence at this conference, especially on ways to reduce the risk of transmission through breast milk. As Elaine Abrams said in her symposium overview, we do have the tools for PMTCT, and we have to move forward. We may know what works, and we may have almost eliminated pediatric AIDS in North America and Europe, but we're still failing to reach 90% of women who need PMTCT services. This is no time for complacency. We need more relevant and rigorous research to be performed by the researchers in this field, and we need to have it on the agenda at these conferences. We need to hear it. Let me end with the activist chant that I think we all picked up. Open your purses, we need more nurses. The issue of nursing staff need was a common theme running through so many presentations in Track B. A quote from a participant in a study from South Africa that was presented by Alta van Dyk sums up that frustration. She said, "If I'd wanted to be an undertaker, I wouldn't have trained as a nurse." If it really is time to deliver, we need hundreds of thousands of new nurses, and we have to support and utilize the ones we have appropriately. So the evidence that we saw as the rapporteur team in hundreds of papers and posters in Track B this week had one overarching theme. We can be successful in treating HIV, in treatment naive and in treatment experienced, in people of all ages, and in rich and in poor countries, and we need to do more. But as Kevin de Kock said, we can't treat our way out of this epidemic, and we need to use these treatment successes to enhance our prevention efforts. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you. I'd like to introduce the lead rapporteur for Track C, Epidemiology, Prevention and Prevention Research, Qureisha Abdul Karim from South Africa.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. I want to start by thanking the organizers for this week, for creating the space for many of us to take stock. And we spend a lot of our time putting out fires, as Greg Gonzalez reminded us. But I think this week has helped us to focus on what we have achieved, to learn from other experiences, other scientific tracks, lived experiences, and just being here so that we can enhance what we do in our individual work, in our individual disciplines, but also as we work in synergy to enhance our response to this pandemic. I also want to thank the previous speakers for laying the ground for moving ahead with my presentation. And like others, I want to thank my team of very dedicated, committed people who worked many hours covering the many sessions, oral sessions, poster discussion, posters, satellites, and I can't do adequate credit in the 15 minutes that I have to capture all that very rich discussion and experience. I must also thank people not listed here as part of the team, but were very generous in informing and picking up on a number of issues emerging that were underrepresented in this conference. So I have to, in the next 15 minutes, cover three broad areas: epidemiology, prevention, and prevention research. I have chosen to select only particular areas and hope they're illustrative of other similar things that I will not focus on specifically, but are as applicable. I want to talk a little bit about the global epidemiology, about understanding the multiple layers of risk, the prevention of known effective strategies, future of prevention, and then summarize. Now, we've seen this many times in the past 6 to 10 days, that HIV continues to spread unrelentlessly throughout the world. We have a total of about 38.6 million people living with HIV. The majority of these are in sub-Saharan Africa. And I think it was the mayor of Toronto at the opening session that reminded us that if we have to look at these numbers and translate that to countries and regions of the world, this is about the entire population of Canada. And if we take the number of new infections or the number of deaths that have occurred only in 2005, this is like wiping out the entire city of Toronto. Now, those are reminders that these are not insubstantial rates of infections, and while some may believe that the epidemic and the pandemic is stabilizing, these data remind us that we have a huge task ahead of us, and that this is not a sprint, nor is it a marathon, but it really is a relay that's going to need not only this generation, but the next generation as well to make a difference. While some of the epidemiological data we have highlight where we need to prioritize our efforts, we also have several examples of rapidly growing epidemics. This conference stands out in the amount of data that it has generated in populations and regions of the world where we have had to date very little information. We've learned a lot more about men who have sex with men, not just as a mode of transmission, but also we have prevalence data and incidence rate data. We've learned a lot more about injecting drug users. We've learned a lot more about marginalized and populations that have been silent in many of these meetings, such as mobile populations, indigenous populations, youth, etc. This geographical distribution show us where the light is, but it also shows us where cracks and glimmers are starting to appear, so that we don't only focus where the greatest burden of infection are, but we take note of emerging epidemics, particularly in Eastern Europe and Asia, so that we don't repeat history and ensure that we bring the best of what we know to turn the tide around in these countries, so that we don't again see the situation that we saw in sub-Saharan Africa and continue to see. Now, there have been a lot of data presented over this week of signs of hope, stabilization of the epidemic, reduction in incidence rate in resource-constrained settings, particularly in Africa. And there are about 6 countries that hold a lot of promise. And we don't know enough and understand enough why this is so. And it behoves us as we move forward to get a better handle on why, so that this may inform our responses in emerging epidemics and re-emerging epidemics in the region. Now, what was of deep concern was data from Uganda. Uganda has been exemplary in its response to the epidemic and has stood out as a leading light in resource-constrained settings of how with political leadership, will, and bringing together everything we know that works, we can turn this around. The data from Uganda show that there is absolutely no room for complacency. We have to be vigilant. As long as there's HIV, HIV can go away, it can come back. We've seen disturbing trends of increase in incidence rate in men between the ages of 40 to 49 in mobile populations, and data from a number of behavioral studies in Uganda demonstrate that it is the increase in additionally of behavioral risk factors that is driving an emerging and a rising increase in HIV infection in Uganda. Now, for many years, we've spoken that HIV is not just simply about the spread of HIV by different modes of transmission, but there are multiple drivers of this epidemic. Chris Behrer, in his opening plenary on Monday, highlighted the issue of the multiple factors influencing risk. At this conference, we've learned from track A, we've learned from track B, we've learned from track C, D, and E, and also from many other sources, how some of these drivers, such as human rights violations, such as trade agreements, all collude to enhance the transmission of HIV. We've learned about drivers at an individual level. We've learned about drivers at a cellular level. We've learned about drivers at a community level and a country level. These data that we have, not just simply that these are drivers, but we now have evidence and data to show us how these drivers enhance transmission. So that we are humbled in our responses to rethink the way we respond to the epidemic, that it's not simply about what we do with individuals, not simply about what we do at regions, but how do we work bringing all a multi-pronged and multidisciplinary approach to this pandemic. One of the false dichotomies in this pandemic has been that between prevention and treatment. And I think in this conference, we've laid that false dichotomy to rest, that it is not just about prevention or treatment, it is about prevention and treatment. It is also important to remember, as we have exemplary examples for scaling up access to treatment, a dire humanitarian need, that we continue to see more new HIV infections. This conference has underscored the importance of prevention, and I underscore it again, that we simply have too many more infections occurring. And as we are trying to put out the fires in terms of increasing morbidity and mortality, that one of the big areas we need to also focus on is how to address better what we know works in terms of preventing HIV infection. We've learned that counseling and testing is an important gateway towards prevention and treatment and care. We also know that there are many challenges in scaling up VCT. There are clear directions in how we can strike balances between the respecting the rights of individuals, human rights, and public health gains, and how to do this. There are good examples of scaling up VCT, which comes up repeatedly as a bottleneck, both for prevention and treatment scale-up. The Ugandan home-based care program is a case in point, where uptake in 15 months across the country increased from 10 to 84%. Botswana also introduced universal counseling and testing, and we can see some impact there. I think there is no one single solution for how we scale up VCT, but we can learn from different examples, and as we implement more novel and innovative strategies, we will learn to refine what we do and impact and enhance what we need to do to make a difference to the epidemic trajectories that we are seeing. We've learned the importance of prevention in people living with HIV/AIDS. And there are data that show very mixed responses in terms of sexual risk. We've seen, for example, in Botswana, increase in condom use, substantial increases. And we've also seen substantial reductions in the number of sexual partners. In India, we've seen how positive married women have 4 times more unplanned pregnancies. And it raises the importance of integrating our services and also highlights how cultural factors impact on risk reduction, ability to control and protect and live healthy lives. In France, we see, in contrast, 17% of men who have sex with men continue to practice unsafe sex, and that about 30% of heterosexual patients continue to have unsafe sex. I think this conference also helped us redefine what is prevention. So prevention in particular groups is just not about harm reduction in injecting drug users. Injecting drug users also have sex. Substance use per se, non-injecting drug use, also carries risk of acquisition. But we've also learned in the context of care that there are a whole lot of prevention modalities. For example, introducing mother-to-child transmission and TB, which James has just highlighted, a major factor. There are a number of ways of preventive prophylaxis impacting and enhancing the quality of life of people living with HIV. We've heard from Alex Wodak that 10% of the global burden of new infections is through injecting drug use. And this conference, as I said earlier, has generated substantially more data on evidence that harm reduction works. And this example in China, where you can see the major impact within 2 years of methadone programs being introduced in 22 provinces for over 15,000 drug users who are making over 10,700 visits per day. That these interventions, even when you start late, you can rapidly, with political will, commitment, and resources, make a huge difference. 14% of all HIV infection is in young people. This is one of the big criticisms in this conference, that not enough attention has been paid to this issue. Is that complacency because we have scale-up of single-dose nevirapine? But there are many, many issues that remain here. Alan Rosenfield in 2000 at the Durban conference reminded us, where is the M in MPCT? At this conference, we saw data how illness stage of mother, both in terms of high viral load and reduction of CD4 counts, can impact on transmission to the infant. We've also had data at this conference that the mortality in both infected and uninfected infants is very much dependent on survival of mothers. And those infants who've lost mothers experience 50% higher mortality rates. And while this conference has highlighted the plight of women, the vulnerability of women, and hope for women, mothers are an important part of that, and mothers are who determine the future. There are a lot more challenges around reducing transmission through breastfeeding, and we cannot afford to lose sight of that. There are innovative combination treatments to further enhance reduction during the intrapartum period, and we need to hear a lot more about that. This perhaps is the single biggest piece in terms of our global failure in terms of translating what we know works to make a difference to the epidemic. It also highlights that having new information alone is not adequate for uptake. And while we have heard a lot about the importance of resources, the importance of capacity building and infrastructure, these are simply not enough. We have learned that there are both push and pull factors. That, for example, if we don't appreciate adequately the behaviors and the context that make people vulnerable and build that into our scale-up efforts, we're simply going to be having a losing battle. As we look to the future, we've had very promising data on pre-exposure prophylaxis. The safety of the use of tenofovir daily has been illustrated, and the need to move very, very rapidly to phase 3 trials. But it also was a reminder for me of the importance of cyberspace. And we had many, many presentations highlighting that we live in a very technologically driven era, and it doesn't matter whether you come from the north or the south. And that technology is influencing our ability to access information, but also risk, and it poses both a threat and an opportunity, and hopefully we hear more about that. This is what we can look forward to in Mexico, and we can see lots more promising results from randomized controlled trials and significant and pivotal studies that we can look to in Mexico. In conclusion, treatment scale-up is creating new opportunities for prevention. We need to improve scale-up of known effective prevention strategies. As the HIV epidemic continues to grow, we appreciate that there is not a single epidemic, but a mosaic of multiple differing epidemics, and that we need to deal with the various drivers of this epidemic, and we need to continue to innovate with new preventions. I would like to close with this quote from Dr. Tony Fauci, that history will judge us not by our scientific advances, by what we do with our scientific advances. I thank you.
Thank you, Teresa. I'd like to introduce to you now the lead rapporteur for Track D, Social, Behavioral, and Economic Science, Michael Tan from the Philippines.
Thank you, Craig. Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. I'll be reporting on Track D, Social, Behavioral, and Economic Science, and I'd like to acknowledge the members of my team, Peter Agleton, Dan Allman, Andrew Ball, Jane Galvao, Ana Luisa Ligori, Ted Myers, Anoki Parikh, Kate Wood. I don't have a picture of the team, but I'd like to assure you it was a proper team. We had representation, multi-continental, multi-sectoral, and multi-gendered. Whoops. In any... Oh dear, I think we have an older version of the presentation, but... In any scientific conference, people tend to look for evidence and impact, but social scientists know that this is always it's not always easy to demonstrate this, given that human beings and societies are not easily subjected to controlled conditions. That's why I've chosen to be a bit more modest and to speak about contributions from the social and behavioral sciences and from economics. I think you'll begin to pick up, too, that there are overlaps in these different tracks. And it will be especially the case here for Track B, considering that we work with both policymakers and with people out in the field. To start off with contributions, the social scientists and economists have helped to look at the situation. We've helped to identify the many hidden epidemics that affect marginalized and excluded groups, notably in this conference, people in prisons and indigenous peoples. This conference also highlighted the situations of mobile populations, migrants, including doctors and nurses who have left their home countries, refugees, internally displaced persons, all of whom have their own particular risks and vulnerabilities. It's not moving. Okay. I'm sorry. Okay. In Track D2, we looked at interventions. I hesitate to put harm reduction in here, but Alex Woda's paper certainly shows that harm reduction works. I did not include it here because I think the studies done here were not really done by social scientists. Social scientists certainly did participate in other studies around ABC, the abstinence, being faithful, and the use of condoms, and have found that gender inequities make this difficult to implement. Antiretroviral treatment can be implemented in resource-poor settings with high adherence. This has been reported by previous tracks. At the same time, we do recognize, again through studies, especially from economists, but also from anthropologists and other social scientists, that there are problems, persistent problems in ART, including patients selling drugs to buy food, patients not being able to afford transport costs, and treatment failure that follows user fees. I refer you to a report from Health Action International Europe, which makes a good case for looking at not just access, but adherence. The treatment access groups, particularly groups of people living with HIV, have shown very clearly how the patent system, how multinational drug monopolies, how TRIPS and free trade agreements have kept ART beyond the reach of the majority of people who need them. It's been skipping. Something wrong with the... There's a missing slide. I'm sorry. Okay. Where are we today in terms of our knowledge? There are knowledge gaps here. And I get the feeling as a social scientist that maybe our studies have contributed more towards an understanding of prevalence rather than of incidence, and at this stage of the epidemic we need more of the latter. One session moderator asked in this conference, where is the sex? And indeed, it seems we've managed quite well to desexualize HIV/AIDS, reducing sex to acts and populations to be analyzed mainly in terms of risks and odd ratios. There are studies that float around but which didn't quite make it to this conference, showing how risks are shaped by identities and meanings. Cross-border studies of sexuality show how a man's behavior, for instance, will shift as he crosses the border. A study by Chris Littleton, for instance, shows that in Thailand, a man may be a truck driver, but when he crosses over to Laos, he's many times over the lion. Literally, the term is used. We still haven't made the transition from sex acts to sexualities. To be more specific, we fail to see how HIV transmission is embedded in people's life goals. This, we had glimpses of this during the conference in papers which referred to the situation of people living with HIV, some of whom talked about the desire to bear children. Certainly, we need to look more closely at relationships and partnering, including the circumstances of risk-taking and risk avoidance around transactional sex, casual sex, temporary marriages, and the many arrangements that migrants and mobile populations have. All of these were not too well represented in this conference. Much has been said, too, about structural factors that affect risk, but there's still an unwillingness, I sense this in the conference, to confront sacred cows, such as the role of much-beloved traditions in creating risk situations. We tend to look at traditions as preserving us, saving us from HIV/AIDS. There's unwillingness to confront the realities here. There were certainly attempts in several sessions to deal with this, as in Beatrice Were of Tasso, in her bold questioning of ABC yesterday, and I paraphrase, I abstained before marriage, I was faithful in my marriage, but I was still infected with HIV. There are many references as well to poverty and the neglect of political leaders, but perhaps we need now to involve historians to document the 25 years of the pandemic and show how many of our macro problems are historically situated in past colonialism and in the new world order of so-called free trade and preemptive wars. And time again during the conference, we've heard that we have the tools, the money, the power to fight the pandemic. We should not forget that there are, in the social sciences, tools that can help us out, even if we don't have the funds and the power. This is especially important as we look to the future. The conference has shown the promise of many new prevention technologies, the advances in antiretroviral therapies, and the moves towards scaling up. Social and behavioral, and economics research will become more urgent now as we talk of all that, of the scaling up, and as the alphabet soup of prevention technologies goes beyond ABC. If I recall right from the plenary presentation of Dr. Geeta Ramji, we have reached letter H. Now, good science begins with asking the right questions. I have here a few questions that came out of the presentations. These questions do not come in any order of importance, but they came through repeatedly during the last few days and kept coming up among our team members. They're not easy questions to answer, but we have to confront them. We start the fundamentals, and I refer here to the origins, the roots of many of the discriminatory attitudes that we have. We have to recognize that these are institutionalized forms of discrimination, so we have to start quite often with our own backyards. The caveat is in order here. Many of us are thinking of fundamentalisms. We have railed too much against Islamist fundamentalism, but forget to document and to look at other religious fundamentalisms, including Christian fundamentalisms. That put people at risk. We need to face up as well to the secular fundamentalisms, particularly neoliberal development, quote-unquote, paradigms that put people at risk. We have reached the stage in antiretroviral therapies where we also need to be asking ourselves, how will we tackle the new needs that grow out of ART, especially as the needs for second-line therapies begin to emerge, given the constraints of political economy, the continuing oppressive patent rules and free trade agreements. If we are unable to deal with first-line treatment, what are we going to do now with the second line of treatment? I asked to social scientists are notorious for irritating the biomedical sector, but we have to do this, and I would like to ask questions here around the frames that we use for our research agenda. The sessions on prevention technologies drew crowds, and inevitably during the open forum, new questions were raised. Most striking were the instances of gender blindness in research designs. We heard of how male circumcision can reduce female-to-male transmission, but people, rightly so, are asking too about the impact of male circumcision in terms of reducing male-to-female and male-to-male transmission. There was silence over this. We heard of vaginal microbicides, but I found a brochure looking rather forlorn in one corner of the hall, asking about rectal microbicides and pointing out how residual homophobia is to be found in our research priorities, failing to recognize that anal intercourse is practiced by both homosexuals and heterosexuals, including young girls seeking to preserve their virginity. Many years back, when female condoms were first introduced, MSM groups asked if it could be used as well for male-to-male sex. I do not recall the question ever being answered, at least not for scientific research. It is unfortunate that we had to schedule an important session on research methodologies only yesterday, but this was a particularly productive session. In one session, Chazan and her colleagues challenged us to rethink our research agenda to make it more proactive and to consider issues of equity and social justice. Vera Paiva of Brazil puts it another way, we need to develop a social public health. The research agenda certainly needs to be crafted with civil society, with people living with HIV and AIDS, prioritizing the lived experiences of people. I had a new version of this, but unfortunately it's not here. I wanted to end with a slide showing a picture, a Chinese paper cut showing workers reaching a so-called floating population. This floating population numbers 100 million Chinese who have moved from rural areas to cities in search of jobs. They epitomize the challenges we face in HIV/AIDS prevention and care, and the urgency for social and behavioral scientists and for economists to help to bring out their voices. Especially for a highly stigmatized issue like HIV/AIDS, we need to look at other ways through which people will express themselves. In this conference, we saw it in the memorial quilts, in the grandmother singing, "We Shall Overcome." It may be time as well to reflect not just on what's been said, but on the silences. During the dictatorship in the Philippines, I once received a card from a political detainee that said it all. Listen to what we are not allowed to say. Thank you.
Thank you, Michael. I'd like to introduce now the lead rapporteur for track E, Policy, Bernard Forbes from the United Kingdom.
Thank you. To an extent, what I'm trying to do here is join together some of the dots. And helping me to do that, my team, Christine from Botswana, Sisonke, South Africa, Zoni from the USA, Aditi from India, and Richard from Canada. I think we kind of spread the world, but see if we did it justice. Last year, world leaders committed to achieving universal access to treatment, prevention, and care. Here in the past week, speakers have highlighted the centrality of human rights in the fight against AIDS. However, human rights are at risk of being relegated to merely another buzzword, with little in the way of concrete action to respect, protect, and fulfill them. Indeed, human rights are under attack in so many quarters, with the predictable consequences of undermining everything else we do. Universal access will never be achieved without human rights. It consists of more than just freedom from discrimination. There's a full range of political, economic, social, and cultural rights that we are ignoring. Public health, policy, and human rights activists must insist there is no competition between human rights and public health approaches. We must accept that human rights are universal, not merely principles driven by developed countries and of equal importance to the dignity of people living with or affected by HIV, wherever their rights are at stake. Looking at vulnerability and marginalization, an emerging issue at the conference was the criminalization of populations seen as contributing to the transmission of HIV infection. That includes sex workers, males who have sex with other males, migrants, and others. And the already existing stigma attached to some marginalized groups, like indigenous people, transgender people, is compounded by the exceptional nature of HIV-related stigma. As some would move us to a more health and medical model of HIV, we have to stop seeing people with HIV as the big problem and start seeing them as key to the solutions, which is where they've been since the outset. In this conference, we've gone beyond focusing only on positive prevention. But treatment and prevention, as we've already heard, relies on the treated. GEPA applies to prevention. I call that positive prevention. Some of us need to get a more meaningful understanding of GEPA, including ensuring the involvement of particular communities of people living with HIV. For children, a number of concerns were raised about the lack of sessions addressing their specific issues. And those that did happen addressed the issues of ensuring access to testing and treatment of children, alongside issues of consent, both to testing and to treatment, which are issues that really were highlighted. For young people, youth presenters spoke about their rights to information, to sexuality education, as well as to services and things like condoms. If this really is a relay and not a marathon, if youth are the future, where are they? Sex workers and their human rights rely on decriminalizing sex work. That's a public health and human rights imperative. We need to learn the value of collaborating respectfully with sex workers also, and particularly in research. People who use drugs, despite clear evidence of what needs to be done, proven interventions are ignored or blocked because policymakers refuse to accept the basic premise that people using drugs have human rights too. Examples include legal prohibitions on opioid substitution in places like Russia, the U.S. ban on federal funding for needle exchange, which is one of the most well-studied and effective measures to address HIV among drug users. And the biggest example for the people here in Canada is the policymakers' refusal to extend a legal exemption permitting the operation of the first safe injection drug site in North America. People in prisons face poor conditions in general. They have lack of access to HIV prevention tools, no condoms, no needles, no substitution therapies. And we heard during the conference some courageous uses of the law to secure access to treatment for those detained in South Africa's Westville prison. For women, the right to autonomy to determine the terms of their sexual relations without fear of violence, and also their inequitable access to resources, education, property rights, and in particular, inheritance rights. For sex workers, I've got the wrong slide, but forgive me. Sex workers, women who use drugs, migrant women, and a range of other women are especially vulnerable and need to be brought into policies and programs. Gay men and other males who have sex with males. In Bangkok, the conference closed with messages about how invisible gay men had been at that event. Here we have gone some way forward. Significant numbers of people living with HIV, though, are gay men and males who have sex with males. So despite advances made towards their legal rights in many parts of the world, there are emerging general epidemics and too little acknowledgement or attention to this vulnerable population. For transgendered people at this conference, there's been an almost complete silence. In formal sessions about human rights and HIV, the vulnerability of this group has come up again. But while there were many transgender people in the Global Village, it's insufficient that there was no attention to these issues within the formal conference program. Looking at prevention, in an era of scale-up, new approaches to testing took a prominent place in the conference debates and in the world's media coverage of what we've been doing. But in particular, speakers cautioned against overriding human rights principles such as the right to informed consent, to confidentiality, and to autonomy in this rush to adopt what people are calling routine testing. Criminalization of HIV was discounted as an effective prevention strategy, particularly because it increases stigma. And there was a lot of discussion regarding new technologies or new uses of existing tools. But risk of detracting from all the other efforts to scale up existing proven prevention work with all this new stuff coming along, and we have to look at the existing condom gap, the lack of access to injecting equipment, and particularly to deal with the issue of mother-to-child transmission. In treatment, care, and support, many examples were provided of how stigma and discrimination are barriers to treatment access. As second-line regimens become more important, trade agreements in particular and intellectual property provisions remain critical barriers to assure that we have national and international policy solutions for access to treatment. While there's progress in developing pediatric formulations, access to these also remains problematic. Whilst there's been much rhetoric on human rights, this is not matched by either resources or by specific targets to hold both the international and national governments accountable. There are global and national policies that are actually impeding the attainment of human rights principles within our response to AIDS. In funding, prominent speakers suggested that the community has failed to deliver on the target set in 2001. Most governments still have to fulfill their commitment to make health a priority. Activists pointed out that despite the fanfare surrounding the launch of the Global Fund, the donors have not resourced what was set up as a vehicle to deliver the exceptional response required by this exceptional disease. Community groups in Toronto have highlighted the fact that it's difficult to access the information required to effectively track the funds and to see whether they're reaching those people in need. Speaker after speaker rallied against donor conditions based on ideological or geopolitical grounds and religious fundamentalism that have had severe and real impact in impeding evidence-based programs at community level, in particular for the most marginalized groups. Research demonstrates that the imposition of financial ceilings on health and education budgets by the IMF is not just economically outdated, but creates barriers to achieving universal access. National finance ministries must explore alternatives. In debates about global aid's architecture, they noted unless the international community works with national governments to invest sufficiently in building health systems, training and recruiting health workers, we won't deliver quality health care. As has already been said, we need more nurses. Until we get them, universal access is just a mirage. In trade, treatment remains out of the reach of the poor. 80% in need still don't have access. Speakers suggested the need to reform international trade rules as well as pharmaceutical industry practices. We were reminded of the WTO Doha Declaration of 2001, recognizing the primacy of public health over pharmaceutical patents. Yet the WTO has yet to come up with a workable mechanism for compulsory licensing that ensures access to lower cost generics for developing countries lacking manufacturing ability. In addition, governments have still to make use of the hard-won gains of Doha and the existing flexibilities of TRIPS to improve access. Delegates in the South particularly are highlighting their concern about governments introducing harsher patent legislation than was actually required by the WTO rules. In conclusion, many speakers have highlighted that we have the science, we have the means, and Canada is such an example of the lack of political will. We need global mechanisms to hold governments and international community accountable to specific targets and deadlines. Many of our international policies are undermining the application of human rights frameworks, as much as our national governments are failing to adhere to the obligations to which they are committed. All of us need to be vigilant. We need to fight against the rollback of fundamental rights as we strive for universal access. Most of what I've said was put on the paper by lawyers. So was that. That's the end of my contribution. Thank you.
Thank you, Bernard. In addition to being the lead rapporteur for the teams covering the sessions addressing the five key challenges, Chris Collins of the United States has also coordinated the overall rapporteur process at this conference and over the past 2 years coordinated the consultative review future directions that I described earlier. Chris Collins.
Thank you. The idea of key challenges was to group together conference sessions, posters, global village events, satellites, and activism that address similar issues. In rapporteuring these sessions, we wanted to look at underlying issues in each challenge. What did we learn about how to address structural barriers? We wanted to be forward-looking. What happened at Toronto that tells us about what has to happen after Toronto? The presentations I'm going to make now, five in one presentations, were prepared by the rapporteur teams for each of the challenge groups, and I apologize in advance for going much too fast. Key challenge one was accelerating research to end the epidemic. Chief rapporteur was Stephanie Nixon. Before all else in research, there is the ethical imperative that participants and their communities are treated fairly. Among many discussions of ethics at this meeting were studies examining the participation of HIV-positive children in HIV research, including those from child-led households. An exploration of the ethical dimensions with this extremely vulnerable group requires urgent attention, considering the rise of research with children. The importance of genuine community engagement in trials also emerged as a theme in several sessions, producing ideas on what some are calling GCP, that is, good community practice. There was good news in treatments. The pipeline of new HIV drugs is healthy. Furthermore, new guidelines for HIV treatment recommend that even heavily treatment-experienced patients with multidrug-resistant virus, the goal of therapy should be to reduce HIV viral load to below 50 milliliters per copy. And there are more arguments than ever, including cost-effectiveness, for the immediate scale-up of universal access. In this context, it's not only time to deliver, but it's also time to measure. Indeed, we need to look to research as a resource management tool. We know what to do. The focus now is how to do it efficiently, using our limited human and financial resources optimally, and how to do it in a sustainable way. For instance, how will we finance and prioritize the next line of drugs? We need not only innovative finance mechanisms for existing products, but new ways to finance innovation. No longer are we just saying that prevention and treatment are inextricably linked. We're now demonstrating it. This came through loud and clear in studies where treatment of the HIV-infected partner in a serodiscordant couple significantly decreased the risk of HIV transmission for the HIV-negative partner. One of the hottest themes at this conference was the growing range of potential prevention technologies. Gita Ranji expanded our ABCs all the way to I. The R&D complexities of these technologies will be addressed in other reports. However, there are several questions of relevance to this key challenge. First, as various prevention tools are available, we will need to evaluate their effectiveness of combination prevention. Second, new prevention strategies, if proven effective, will ideally decrease incidence rates in hard-hit communities, meaning that future prevention trials will require larger sample sizes and or longer time frames to demonstrate efficacy. Third, new prevention technologies such as microbicides received a boost in profile from the two bills, Clinton and Gates. Their recommendations were welcome ones that most people can agree with. But is it wise for a conference agenda to be so influenced by an ex-politician and a billionaire as opposed to people living with HIV their communities, and the researchers with whom they work? Fourth, we must question whether this focus has eclipsed the fact that we already have existing, proven, cost-effective technologies such as PMTCT, for which scale-up has been appallingly slow. Think about it. If we already had full coverage of PMTCT, we could have eradicated pediatric HIV by now. While new prevention technologies, especially vaccines, are essential to ending AIDS, these tools will only be successful if they are accessible, affordable, acceptable, and used. Conditions which are determined by many of the same economic and social and political forces that are driving the epidemic in general. To truly end the epidemic, we will need to accelerate research that helps understand ways of ameliorating the gross inequalities and social vulnerabilities that fuel HIV. This is not a new debate, but it's a debate that needs to be renewed. Finally, there are some areas where the evidence on efficacy and cost effectiveness is incredibly robust, and all that remains is to put these strategies into action. One such area is harm reduction, where the evidence in favor is abundant, compelling, and consistent. In the words of Alex Wodak, the scientific debate is now over. Indeed, the research challenge is to learn operational lessons for the urgently needed expansion of harm reduction programs, including the renewal of support for Canada's only supervised injection facility from the Harper government before the September 12 exemption deadline. Key challenge two was expanding and sustaining human resources to scale up treatment and prevention, and our chief rapporteur was Subha Raghavan. The health workforce shortage is a major crisis, with over 1 million health workers needed in Africa alone. Dr. Rubenstein warns us that it is going to take a huge amount of money, supplies, health infrastructure, salaries, and salary supplements, as well as task shifting to address this crisis. Mark Haywood said that the human resource crisis is not just a global crisis, but a globalized crisis, and will require a global strategy. This approach, we need to advocate with WHO to bring health workers in as part of the formal workforce. In countries like Botswana, 40% of health workers will die if they are not treated, and this will, of course, worsen the health care worker shortage. Dr. Stanton urges to find predictable financing and to develop a bold plan for scale-up of needed human resources. Mark stressed the urgency of reaching an international agreement that binds countries in the conduct and distribution of healthcare workers. Dr. Gurma said that we urgently need to mobilize $7.2 billion to fund the Treat, Train, and Retain initiative of WHO. It's also critical that we advocate for removal of fiscal barriers imposed by international agencies. In order to rapidly scale up treatment programs in the absence of doctors, the scope and role of nurses and community-based workers needs to change. But these workers need to be paid. Current programs involving community health workers use various formats for provision of care and treatment, which needs to be standardized for health care workers. There's also an urgent need for developing and implementing sustained, uniform training for community health workers. A study from Vietnam has shown that integrating care, support, and treatment programs with district-level health facilities increases access to comprehensive services, reduces stigma and discrimination, and enables capacity building of the healthcare workforce. A study from Kenya established that facility-level decentralization of pediatric HIV care optimizes treatment outcomes and sustains benefits of PMTCT services. Studies from India and Zambia have clearly shown that partnership with all the allied health programs are critical for treatment scale-up. If rigorous prevention, care, support, and treatment programs are implemented at the workplace, further attrition of the health workforce can be avoided. This is an urgent need to strengthen HIV policies and programs at the workplace, both in public and private sectors in the majority of countries. Key challenge three, intensifying the involvement of affected individuals and communities. Our chief rapporteur was Gail Steckley. It's important to remind ourselves, why GIPA? Greater involvement does have many benefits for individuals who get involved. Jeannie Nazyama shared a Rwandan proverb, "To be healed, we must speak." But the main point is to achieve a more effective response for the benefit of all. There is fairly general agreement on the value of the concept of GIPA, but much criticism from people living with HIV and AIDS, some constructive, some less so, of how it is played out in practice. Why is it so hard, and how can we do it better? We need to document and celebrate our successes. Where necessary, fight to sustain them. Successes like the whole model of patient-centered care, Vancouver's safe injection site, and New Zealand's decriminalization of sex work. The self-proclaimed dinosaurs need to share their experience and their skills and foster the energy of a new generation of activists. Funders need to invest in developing the capacity of young individuals and groups to engage in unfamiliar processes. It's not enough to invite them to take part. They must receive adequate training and adequate support. There is not enough MEPA, meaningful involvement. Members of affected communities need to insist their involvement be meaningful at all levels and, where necessary, refuse token engagement or engagement that threatens their autonomy. The tsunami of the Global Fund has overwhelmed many smaller groups and changed individual expectations of engagement. People living with HIV and AIDS who work deserve to be paid like anyone else. However, many expressed a concern that involvement is now too often interpreted as employment. Women's Place at AIDS 2006 is just one example of power alliances to make things happen, with little financial support and very little time. Women's voices were really heard at this conference. What are the most important steps that we can take? The barrier posed by stigma and discrimination cannot be overstated. Involvement of community members helps to reduce stigma and discrimination, but stigma and discrimination continue to prevent the majority from getting involved. Human rights groups and groups representing people living with HIV and other affected communities need to advocate hand-in-hand for changes in discriminatory laws. Eliminating stigma is more difficult, but change is happening. For example, one of many examples is in Malawi, where a national radio show broadcasts people living with HIV and AIDS reading weekly diaries of their lives. Use of mass media is fostering open dialogue and overcoming stigma. The only real solution to intensifying the involvement of affected communities is reducing their vulnerability and reducing the spread of AIDS. To do this, we have to decriminalize the practices and behaviors that facilitate the spread of the virus. For people who use drugs, the only real solution is peace in the war on drugs. To achieve these ends, activism and engagement must be intensified. Activists discussing 25 years of community engagement agreed that as long as there is injustice, there is a place for radical activism. At the same time, involvement must include a place at the decision-making table. Why involvement? Only with full, meaningful, sustained involvement of the most affected communities can we really stop AIDS. Key challenge 4, building new leadership. The significance of leadership has been made abundantly clear in this conference and was compellingly reflected in yesterday's plenary session, Time to Deliver the Price of Inaction. Powerful speakers, bringing their intelligence, commitment, and passion to bear upon this conference, inspired many of us to strive harder to fully utilize their skills and talents in the response to HIV and AIDS. Throughout the conference, we've heard many people call for greater leadership to be demonstrated, from political leaders, religious leaders, business leaders, and the leaders of UN agencies. Sometimes natural leadership emerges, but we must be proactive in nurturing and building it as well. This key challenge asks us to explore how this can be done. And Julia Kabasti was the lead rapporteur on this. Carol McKay's insights in yesterday morning's plenary shed light on the answer. The most powerful way to build leadership among young people, she said, is a true adult-youth partnership, where space is created for young people at the center of the response, a space where their contribution is valued and acted on, where young people are part of the decision-making and have a platform for action, where their successes are celebrated and they have the support they need to learn to overcome the challenges. The Grandmother's March at the Forum in the Global Village showed us the gentle and proud leadership of grandmothers caring for their orphan grandchildren, a monumental role they shoulder that for the most part goes unnoticed. Their leadership affects the ways communities perceive the caring role. During the conference, we also learned the Ethiopian Business Coalition Against HIV/AIDS is showing the way business leaders can mobilize and take ownership of the need to address HIV/AIDS in their workplaces by developing and sharing necessary skills, knowledge, and the experience to do so. Even more importantly, they contribute to setting standards that inspire others to do the same. The launch of the Youth Harm Reduction Network took place in the Global Village. The network is an initiative designed to foster and support young leaders working on harm reduction. Such efforts speak to the crucial role that civil society organizations should play in fostering community leaders. To do so, they must have the vision and they must have the resources. Exercising leadership is not simply a choice between action and inaction, nor is it just a matter of capacities or of goodwill. While many of the sessions in this conference identified the need for leadership, too few of them addressed the task of developing real prerequisites of leadership: heart, knowledge, skills, legitimacy, space, and resources. The task ahead is to do just that. Key challenge 5, scaling up lessons from the field, and our chief rapporteur was Fatima Hassan. We all know that the price of inaction is death, but life is in our hands. We have the tools to treat in all settings. in resource-limited settings, rural, and post-conflict settings. Studies showed this week that scale-up with what we have now is possible even in post-genocide Rwanda, so there is no excuse for delay. Universal access means we treat everyone, but are we? Studies showed this week that we're leaving out children. There are 600,000 new infant infections every year, but only 5 to 8% are getting treatment. Studies showed this week that we're leaving out gay-identified men and men who have sex with men, sex workers, injection drug users, prisoners, displaced people, indigenous people, and racial and ethnic minorities. We need scale-up of VCT, including home-based and mobile VCT, without losing the human rights protections that are necessary. We need to strengthen health systems and integrate VCT, PMTCT, TB, and with HIV prevention, care, and treatment services, and to decentralize to include community and primary clinics in the response. We need to make more use of existing simple and affordable monitoring tools like CD4 viral load and dry blood spot PCR. We need to ensure sustainable drug supplies and lower drug prices. As Jim Kim told us, we need a second wave of activism, of access activism, to deal with issues such as pricing of second-line drugs. And Jim also reminded us that if the United States just took a two-day break in the war in Iraq, we could do the health worker expansion that we need to get the services out. Will the developing countries, the less developing countries, WHO, the rich countries, and the UN please stand up, monitor and rectify aspects of pharmaceutical policies and IP protection to scale up? We must have leadership from states, scientists, and healthcare workers. It is 4 years to 2010 and the promised universal access. We need detailed targets, and we need plans, and we need the resources. We need billions, not millions, universal access to prevention, care, and treatment for everyone, simpler, cheaper, accurate monitoring tools, pediatric formulations, lower prices for Keletra, rifabutin, and second-line drugs, inclusion of volunteers, community workers, and people living with HIV and AIDS, resources and research into female-controlled barrier methods, a plan to truly address socioeconomic drivers, including abolishing user fees, law and policy reform so that we do not criminalize the conduct of MSM, gay men, sex workers, IDUs, and displaced people. And we need donors to drop the conditions that impede access to prevention, care, and treatment. PEPFAR, drop the conditions. In sum, we've seen that all these challenges, these five and many more, are all eminently possible to overcome. We wanted the key challenges to focus on practical solutions, but the biggest barriers we face don't have to do with straightforward issues of implementation. They have to do with political priorities and institutions that choose to move too slow, and stigma and marginalization. One thing that's been important about this conference is the acknowledgement of the urgent need to greatly expand prevention, the prevention effort, and for new prevention interventions. And when we talk about making prevention more broadly available to general populations and to people who are marginalized, to people in rural areas and to people in cities, what we're really talking about is about building health systems, sustainable community health systems that can provide treatment, prevention, TB, and reproductive health services. We need greatly expanded prevention for all people if we're going to make treatment sustainable. And by the same token, we need greatly expanded treatment access to make prevention sustainable. So it's time to deliver. It's time to truly integrate prevention and treatment. It's time to hold our governments and international institutions to account. It's time to base policy on evidence. And it's time to fully fund Global Fund Round 6. I'd like to thank all the rapporteur teams, all of the 60-plus people who worked on rapporteuring. It was a wonderful group. And I'd also like to thank the other people that worked on the key challenges, Evan Collins, Darian Taylor, Andrea Napieri, and Sam Averett. And I'd like to also thank, finally, Anna Brammer, who helped all of us all this week. Thank you.
Thank you. We now have three statements, one from the community program, one from the leadership program, and one from the youth program. I'd like to introduce Olayide Akani from Nigeria, who has led the preparation of the community program statement.
Good morning. Thank you very much. I'd like to say a big thank you to my team members who have helped to make my job easier. Wherever you're seated here, you're the best. Justin Hill, Lockie Mazubiko, Rodrigo Olin-German, Sunil Babupant, and Shona Shkonim. There was a lot of discussion all through the past 5 days between grandmothers, between community people, between scientists. So what were all the people talking about? What were they saying? I have a few key messages which I have outlined here. The first key message is the fact that women are the ones bearing the brunt of the HIV epidemic. And there's a need to address the power dynamics that affect women. There needs to be meaningful integration of women issues into HIV and AIDS programs. There needs to be access to preventive and reproductive health services, microbicides, female condoms, PMTCT and ART services. Women and girls need to be empowered and educated. There needs to be an addressing of social and cultural issues, such as land and inheritance rights. And there needs to be programs to address the specific stigma and discrimination issues as it relates to women. Another key message was the fact that vulnerable populations need to be brought to the discussion table. As one participant rightly said, there is nothing for us without us. Human rights of all individuals should be protected. Evidence-based prevention programs work. We have seen that being presented all over and over again in this meeting. And there's a need to repeal discriminatory laws and support comprehensive evidence-based interventions. And that will include supporting comprehensive IDU harm reduction programs, access to ARVs for prison populations, migrants, refugees, indigenous people, men who have sex with men, sex workers, youth, as well as orphans and vulnerable children. Another key message was that universal access will only be achieved when we address the following issues: when we link prevention and treatment efforts, when we address the issues of stigma and discrimination, when we approach universal access from a human rights perspective and address the needs of all the marginalized groups I had mentioned earlier, when we review current free trade agreements which are currently impeding access to generics, when countries set national targets for achieving universal access and implement these targets, when we promote treatment literacy, and when we promote TB and HIV collaborative activities at country level. The next key issue was resource mobilization, and from all the discussions, governments at every level need to increase their funding. But this does not exclude the fact that the international community also needs to be responsive to the needs of countries. But they need to mobilize resources that actually address the priority needs of the countries and not push down things that they want down countries' throats. We need to make the money work. We need to find innovative mechanisms for funding grassroots organizations. Oftentimes there has been a lot of talk about the fact that the grassroots people who are doing work at the grassroots are not sufficiently mobilized to do the great work that they are doing. And the fifth key message was the fact that community involvement and participation is still very tokenistic. We need to equip community groups with the skills to effectively engage with key stakeholders in research, in policy-making processes, in monitoring and evaluation, and in actually monitoring what is going on the ground. We need to broaden the concept of greater involvement of people living with HIV. And in doing that, we also need to develop benchmarks for evaluating GEPA and community involvement. The last key message was the issue of accountability, and I believe that almost every session touched on that. Governments need to urgently deliver on their commitment, and it's not only government. Civil society groups also need to be accountable to their constituencies. We also need to ensure that we promote the watchdog roles of civil society. it needs to be more pronounced. Civil society should be able to advise government and make suggestions that will improve the quality of the response in their countries. And the last message that I have, which was highlighted very strongly at the session on inaction, the price of inaction yesterday, simply say, well, it's time to deliver. And as Mark Haywood said, we have all the means, but will we utilize the means? Will we utilize them? That's the message that we need to take home. We know what is working, but how do we make it work? Are we going to make it work? Thank you for listening.
Thank you. I'd like to introduce now Lyndon Haviland of the United States, who led efforts to pull together the leadership program statement.
Good morning. We have the tools, we have the medicines, we have the tests, but do we have the political will? That's all we heard this week. We need to do it. If it is indeed the question of the conference, the question is how to identify, engage, and nurture leaders from all sectors and at all levels. We heard a sense of urgency. We heard over and over again that the time to act is now. The AIDS pandemic is outpacing current leadership. We have seen in this epidemic extraordinary leadership at all levels, in communities of people living with AIDS, at the United Nations, in government, in our churches, in our schools, and in our communities, in corporations, and in the private sector. But we need more. This conference, more and more, we heard that to be a leader in the fight against AIDS, we know that means that we must wake up each day, and we know that what we have done is not enough. We're not even close. 25 years into the epidemic, 40 million HIV infections, we haven't done enough, but we can. We have to maintain our sense of urgency, but plan for the long haul. We need to challenge ourselves, and we need to sustain one another. We also heard a theme, a key theme of accountability. We can hold our political leaders accountable. They're supposed to answer to us. I haven't seen that yet. Universal access must move from rhetoric to reality. We know today we have more financial resources than ever before, but how do we move into actual targets, actual numbers? Universal access sounds great, but from what I've seen and from what I've heard, we're not even close. The U.S. hasn't set a target. When are we going to get there? History will judge us on whether this is a missed opportunity or a great reality. Each of one of us has a role to play. Yesterday we were told that public health workers, scientists, every one of us has an advocacy role, and every one of us needs to hold each other and hold our governments, our communities, our families accountable. We heard at this conference about new epidemics, epidemics in different communities, people of the African diaspora. In America, the face of the epidemic is black, and black leaders are responding. IDUs, MSM, people of indigenous communities, they are disproportionately impacted by the epidemic. And the challenge is to find new leaders, sustain them, engage them, and put them at the front of our fight. We need to have not involvement, but full integration. Finally, I'd like to end with an action step. Hold governments accountable. Scrutinize national targets. They're supposed to make targets by December. Do we know what those targets are? We have a role to play. Ask about them. Demand about them. Hold people accountable to June's political declaration of high-level review. This is an action step. We can be a part of the solution. Make Mexico City reflect the epidemic. Seems like a radical thought. Invite the leaders of the G8. Tell them today the dates we know. August 3rd to 8th, Mexico City. We'll see you there. There is no excuse for a lack of leadership. They need to be there, and we can help them do it. And I look forward to seeing you all in Mexico. Bye.
Thank you. I think one of the hugely noticeable differences here from Bangkok was the number of young people, almost double the number that were in Bangkok. I'd like to introduce the leader of the youth program team who developed the program statement, Colleen Patterson from Canada.
Hi, I am a young Algonquin woman, and I would like to take the time to acknowledge the traditional territory of the Mississauga peoples whose conference this was held on. I want to thank all of you who have stayed here, and to all the people who just walked out on community leadership and youth, shame on you. Where are my youth voices in the audience? Can I hear them, please? Let's have our voices heard. When I say youth, you say listen, youth. When I say youth, you say truth, youth. When I say youth, you say access, youth. When I say youth, you say money, youth. When I say youth, you say sex, youth. When I say youth, you say time to deliver, youth. Youth! Youth! That's what I'm talking about. I want to thank my assistants. They're superstars. They've been with me 15 hours a day around the clock to bring you the report on today's presentation for the week. The Youth Pavilion was a huge success. Dr. Peter Pyatt has been a great support to us, and you said you know more about the youth force than anything else at this conference. Thank you. There are 1,000 youth at this conference, the most youth than any other conference in conference history. We've been told that the Youth Pavilion is the most interactive booth in the entire global village. Thank you to all of the staff and volunteers who made that happen. The Youth Adult Commitment Desk provided adult conference participants an opportunity to articulate how they will work in partnership with youth to improve the situation of youth-focused HIV/AIDS programs, policies, etc. Commitments made will be tied to the outcomes and will be time-specific. These commitments will be followed up by post-conference via existing global youth networks. Thank you to our 350 adult partners who put your commitments in writing. One of the most important commitments that involve youth at this conference is that for AIDS 2008 in Mexico, the Honorable Dr. Frank, Minister of Health, has committed to double the number of young people. We want our marginalized youth represented. We want our indigenous youth represented, and I believe that is my next slide. Yes, it is. There needs to be more representation of youth from marginalized groups, including HIV-positive youth, street-involved youth, indigenous peoples from the four colonized countries of Australia, New Zealand, Canada, and the United States, and we support our Pacific Islanders indigenous people. We want more Asian faces. And our African youth from the United States are feeling marginalized at this conference. They have different issues than what's happening in Africa, and you need to support your brothers and sisters. Gay, lesbian, bisexual, transgender, transsexual peoples, commercial sex trade workers, injection drug users. Youth with disabilities had a hard time getting around this conference venue. We want them to be able to access what the rest of us can access if we are here. Our mobile and migrant populations, they need to be here too. It's difficult, it's a challenge, but we must find a way to figure that out. Action. More funding for youth programs. Youth want to be seen as equal participants in program and policy. We want to be active participants. We want to be leaders. And we want to have an education and understanding of how politics collide with this epidemic. There's a lot of stuff going on here. Some of us don't understand it, and we need to have that information in ways that we can understand it, take back to our communities, and put it into action and make that usable. We want accurate, usable prevention education so that youth can make safer decisions for themselves. I keep hearing all about the alphabet acronyms and expanding on the ABCs. We want to expand to DES. Don't eliminate our future. Thank you to Mary Robinson for relaying this message from the youth that she works with. So one of the key items, key quotes that stands out for us at this conference was from Crown Princess Mette Marit of Norway. We are all in the fortunate position of making a positive change. It is time for leadership, time to deliver. When we go to Mexico in 2008, we want our marginalized people represented on the traditional territory of the Aztec peoples. The Youth Pavilion has been a great success. All of the youth who have participated, congratulations, good work. You did an amazing job. Everybody, thank you.
Thank you very much, Colleen. Now, before anyone leaves, a few things to say. First of all, even though people did leave the room before the leadership community and youth program, most did not. And I see this room full of people, and I think that it says that most of you here realize that this meeting now is not just about science, it's about youth, it's about community, it's about leadership. So thank you. Three more things to say. The first, all of these people up on the stage today and the over 60 other individuals who supported them this week have been working night and day, and I mean virtually all night and day, to try and cover the vast program that this conference is and to synthesize it into the incredible presentations this morning that were all within time. Thank you to all of you and your team. Two more things. The first, many of you know, but many of you don't, that local health hotel workers unions in Toronto have been engaged in a long, many-month run series of negotiations for better wages and working conditions. After many, many months, they have been in a legal strike position. But they agreed, because of their commitment to HIV and AIDS, that they would not go on strike until this conference ended. Thank you to all of the hotel workers in this city. Finally, we're going to finish now for a brief 15 minutes to set up, technical setup. As I mentioned at the beginning, Yvonne Chaka Chaka from South Africa will then sing and perform at about 11:20. And then we'll go straight into the closing session at 11:30. With Stephen Lewis highlighting that session as the keynote speaker. So please don't go far. If you need to, go to the bathroom, but don't go far, because we'll be back in 15 minutes. Thank you. Thank you so much.